They are elected by you, I am elected by you. I am constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
On March 24, 2022, Judge Stephen Swartz joined the Federalist Society's Notre Dame student chapter to provide an introduction to the Court of Federal Claims. Professor David Waterlove provided a response and moderated a live Q&A. The following is the audio from that event. We hope you enjoy.
Thank you, Caitlin. As Caitlin said, my name is Nicholas DeAndre, and I am the treasurer for the Notre Dame Federalist Society. It's my pleasure to introduce our speakers for today. First, we have Judge Stephen S. Swartz. Judge Swartz was nominated to the U.S. Court of Federal Claims on June 7, 2017, confirmed on December 8, 2020, and received his commission on December 22, 2020. Judge Swartz graduated from Yale College in 2005. He received his JD from the University of Chicago Law School, where he was online editor of the University of Chicago Law Review and a Hinton Moot Court finalist. He clerked for Judge Jerry E. Smith on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Following his clerkship, Judge Swartz was a litigation associate at a D.C. law firm, focusing his practice on appellate and administrative law matters. He then joined a nonprofit where he litigated cases related to federal government transparency and administrative agency discretion. In 2016, he joined a D.C. litigation boutique, where he represented state and local governments in a complex trial court and appellate proceedings, becoming a partner in 2017. A native of Winona, Minnesota, he lives with his family in Arlington, Virginia. Secondly, we have Dr. David P. Waterlove. Dr. Waterlove is a legal historian of early modern England, special interest in equity in the Court of Chancery. His research considers the development of the law of property and finance in relation to social and economic realities in history. Before joining the faculty of Notre Dame Law School in 2019, he was a fellow of St. Catherine's College, Cambridge, and a fellow in private law at Harvard Law School. He also clerked for the Honorable Morris S. Arnold of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, and he practiced commercial litigation. Dr. Waterlove earned his PhD in English legal history from the University of Cambridge, a JD magna cum laude from the University of Michigan, an MAR with concentration in theology from Yale University, and BA and MA in theology and religious studies from the University of Cambridge. I'll turn now over to Judge Swartz. Please join me in welcoming him to Notre Dame Law School.
It's nice to be here. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure. This is my first time on the Notre Dame campus. It's wonderful to have the opportunity. When I was a law student, if I thought of the Court of Federal Claims at all, I thought of it as this kind of strange body whose vaguely pitiable judges weren't even allowed to publish their opinions in the federal supplement. I learned in practice how wrong I was. I'm here to help you avoid making the same mistake that I did, and I'll offer you a few reasons why you ought to care about the Court of Federal Claims. After that, I'll spend a few minutes telling you a little bit about how I ended up there. So the first reason you ought to care about the Court of Federal Claims is in comparison with its historical alternative. So the United States, as a sovereign, is generally immune from lawsuit. This is creatively referred to as sovereign immunity. But since the beginning of the Republic, it has always managed real and personal property, and it has always employed people, and it has always entered into contracts. And so by the operation of its functions as a sovereign, as a proprietor, as an employer, as a buyer and seller, the United States has left in its wake a trail of people who believe that they're morally entitled to some kind of compensation from the sovereign. So the question has always just been how to handle these people. Originally, these kinds of claims against the federal government were handled by what are referred to as private bills, which is basically what it sounds like. It's a bill passed by Congress that instead of setting a general federal policy or spending money on a public work of some sort, gives a particular sum of money to a particular person for a particular reason. The problem was that Congress was never really set up to handle this kind of recurring business in a fair way. If what you want is methodologically consistent resolution of a category of issues that leads to like results in like cases, what you really want isn't legislation. What you really want is adjudication. And for that, what you need is something that's set up not as a legislature, but something that's set up as a court. And so over the course of the 19th century, Congress started moving toward an adjudicative model for resolution of these kinds of claims against the federal government. In 1855, Congress created what it called the United States Court of Claims, which is the predecessor of the modern day Court of Federal Claims. The old Court of Claims was originally staffed by a group of people with the title of judge who were to hold their office during good behavior and who were authorized to handle claims for money against the United States arising out of federal laws and contracts. This originally was kind of a fiasco because Congress didn't give the court the authority to enter judgments, meaning that you still needed the private bill when the court was done, meaning that you had all of the problems that attended the system of needing private bills, except for twice the work, because before you could even get into Congress to get your private bill, you needed to go through this whole adjudicative process first, which would lead to a recommendation to Congress and another round of work. So it was Abraham Lincoln, in fact, who suggested in his first message to Congress that the Court of Claims be given the power to enter final judgments so that it would become more like a court and more able to handle these kinds of claims efficiently. Sometime after that, in the 1880s, the Tucker Act expanded the Court of Claims power to roughly the scope of the modern Court of Federal Claims power, which is claims for money based on the Constitution, federal statutes, federal regulations, federal contracts. So the result is that there is now an adjudicative process for people to bring their claims against the United States instead of people having to go through a process in Congress. That's one reason you ought to care that there's a court there. I'll give you a second reason that you ought to care about the Court of Federal Claims, and that's because of the way that it sheds light on issues of federal powers, institutions, issues of relation between Congress and the courts, issues about the nature of the judicial power. Because if you're interested in those questions, and you should be, because it'll make your law practice a lot happier and a lot more fun, you need to be thinking about the Court of Federal Claims. And I'll give you a couple of examples, because the way the Court of Federal Claims exists now is shaped by 100 years of interactions between the Congress and the Supreme Court. So here's one example. One of the early questions attending the old Court of Claims was whether its decisions were reviewable by the United States Supreme Court, whether its judgments were reviewable. And that turned into a question of what makes a decision, a judicial judgment. So originally, the Court of Claims point could issue a judgment, but no money could be paid on the judgment unless the judgment was submitted to the Secretary of the Treasury, and the Secretary of Treasury had the opportunity to do an estimation or essentially a revision of the judgment. And there was a question about whether it was possible for the Supreme Court to review a decision that could be revised within the executive branch. And the Supreme Court said no. And there was an interesting division of opinion within the Supreme Court on why. And was complicated by the death of Chief Justice Taney when the issue was before the court. Chief Justice Taney took the view that a judgment isn't really a judgment from a court unless the court has the ability to actually execute the judgment, which in the case of the Court of Federal Claims would mean levying on some aspect of federal property and selling it off in order to pay off a plaintiff. Interestingly enough, Chief Justice Taney died when this was only in a draft opinion. And so the court's opinion issued, the decision issued without the opinion, which was then not published for another 20 years or so. I didn't know the Supreme Court could do that until I started learning about this. His successor, Chief Justice Chase, took a different view. He said, no, the problem isn't execution. The problem is revision, because if you have a judgment that can be revised by the government, it's just an advisory opinion. The Supreme Court can't review advisory opinions. So what happened? Congress repealed the provision that required revision by the Secretary of the Treasury, so the judgments were final and couldn't be revised by administrative officers. And the Supreme Court then began accepting jurisdiction of appeals from the Court of Federal Claims. This teaches us things about what it is to be a court and what it is for a court to issue a judgment. A second example of ways that the Court of Federal Claims sheds light on constitutional structure issues is how the Court of Federal Claims ended up as an Article I court. So from the beginning, that goes back to the very beginning of the court. So at the beginning of the court, there were questions about whether the United States Court of Claims was really a court or whether it was more like an administrative board that was there to resolve certain kinds of administrative issues. And this was complicated by the fact that the old Court of Claims was receiving requests from Congress to consider and make recommendations on potential private bills. So you've got a body that's considering cases and controversies, again, involving the United States based on a waiver of sovereign immunity, but you also have it issuing advisory opinions to Congress. There's a question about how to explain all of this. So one explanation early on was to adopt this, to my eye, peculiar legal fiction that Congress was a court of equity and was referring legal issues to a court of law for resolution, which I guess was something that used to happen before the merger of law and equity. The Supreme Court stepped in the 1930s and said, actually, this is an Article I court. It's not an Article III court, because what it's doing is just carrying out Congress's authority to pay the debts of the United States under Article I. Congress responded to that. Congress didn't agree with that, and Congress responded by passing a law declaring that the Court of Claims was an Article III court. And then it went back to the Supreme Court, which said, all right, okay, it's an Article III court, but there's a problem with these private bills. If you're going to call it an Article III court, you can't be asking it for advisory opinions. And so Congress essentially had gotten what it wanted, but at the cost of having having an institution that it could use to get advice on private bills. Congress's solution to that went to the issue bounced back from the Supreme Court to Congress was the fault was as follows. Congress had given the Court of Claims the power to hire what it called trial commissioners to hear evidence and to hold trial proceedings that then would be reviewed by the Court of Claims. And what Congress did was it created a mechanism for referring the questions about private bills to the trial commissioners who weren't Article III judges. And then the result of that was the result of that was sort of a peculiar system for how the Court of Claims worked, because the Court of Claims had basically become an Article III appellate body and a place for resolving issues of law. The issues of fact were being resolved by these trial commissioners who were also there to get referrals from Congress on private bills. And so in 1982, Congress created something more like the modern system. It abolished the Court of Claims and reconstituted it with the old judges as the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. It abolished the trial commissioners, but redesignated the trial commissioners as a new Court of Claims, as a new, what it called a claims court, later renamed the Court of Federal Claims. The result being that you've got a new body that's there to handle trials on issues involving claims against the United States. It can also handle requests from Congress for advice on private bills, and appeals from the Court of Federal Claims go up to the Federal Circuit. So the result again is this back and forth between Congress and the Supreme Court that you could fill up volumes researching and trying to understand, that leads to creation of an Article I body exercising delegated authority from Congress and an Article III body that reviews it. Third and last reason that I'll give for why the Court of Federal Claims ought to matter to you is because you need to be familiar with it when you go into practice. Right now, the Court of Federal Claims has either sole or concurrent jurisdiction to handle a wide array of claims for money and certain other kinds of relief that you might have against the federal government. And so there is a wide variety of areas of practice, particularly commercial law practice, where your client might end up adverse to the federal government and in need of money, and where the place you will most likely, or one place where you could end up, would be the Court of Federal Claims. So some examples, issues involving federal government contracts, issues involving tax refunds, issues of employment disputes involving federal employment, issues of takings of property by the federal government, issues of infringement of intellectual property by the federal government. If these issues come up for you, and there's a strong chance at least one of them will over the course of your career, you'll end up in my court very likely. So what you need to be thinking about is what it would be like to be practicing in the Court of Federal Claims. And what you would find is that it's very much like practicing in front of a federal district court. You'd be in front of a judge who is nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. We don't have Article III lifetime tenure protections, but we've got something very similar to that, and actually somewhat cushier than that by statute, which I can tell you about later. It's really very nice. I'm very happy about it. So you won't notice a big difference in terms of the judge you're in front of. There's some differences. So we have our own rules. We aren't subject to the federal rules of civil procedure. We make our own rules, but they track the federal rules very, very closely, with a couple of exceptions that you might want to be aware of. So for example, the federal government hasn't waived it hasn't consented to a jury trial in the Court of Federal Claims. So it would be a bench trial, no juries. The procedures for creating a class action are a little bit different. They're only opt-in class actions, basically, so the federal government can keep a handle on how many people are going to be a member of a class. Some of the jurisdictional issues are a little bit different because we exist because of a waiver of statute of sovereign immunity. So some issues that would be just claims processing rules in a federal district court are non-waivable jurisdictional issues that a court has to address in the Court of Federal Claims, like the statute of limitations. So in district court, you could waive an objection. You or the government could waive an objection to statute of limitations. In the Court of Federal Claims, it's non-waivable, and I have to address it on my own authority. So if you're aware of these kinds of procedural differences, though, you'll be ready to practice there. One difference, but one thing that you should be aware of with the Court of Federal Claims is that you're always opposite the federal government. So there's always going to be a Department of Justice lawyer on the other side, sometimes with the support of another commercial entity, maybe that might intervene in support of the government. Some people find that a little frightening because they think that the Department of Justice is all powerful and that its lawyers are 10 feet tall with IQs of 160. But you'll eventually realize, or should train yourself to understand, that it's the federal government's law firm, and that the lawyers are just like you, meaning that they're bright, dedicated lawyers who are just a little bit overextended and doing their best on behalf of their clients. And so you'll regard the Court of Federal Claims as a place where you are ready, willing, and able to march into when the situation demands it. So three reasons, in short, why you ought to care about the court and be familiar with it and ready to practice there. So I also thought I would tell you a bit about how I ended up on the court, which is a fun story, and hopefully you find it as fun as I did. So I went to law school. I clerked. I went into practice at a big firm in D.C. where I had no future and was miserably unhappy most of the time. But I learned a lot. I had the opportunity for training or experience or observation of pretty much everything from filing a complaint all the way through Supreme Court argument. And I had the opportunity to work with some exceptionally talented lawyers who taught me a lot and gave me some opportunities for personal and professional growth that set me up for being able to tackle big jobs in the future. One of the things that I learned how to do there was administrative law litigation involving federal agencies. And so I took that. I went to a nonprofit where I was going to largely sue federal agencies over abuses of discretion type issues. That was really fun for the first few months, but then there was a change of management there, and a new guy got to work running the place into the ground as hard and fast as he could. The new guy was a Notre Dame guy. I don't hold that against you, at least not individually. But here's how I reacted to that. So I very quickly figured out that there was nothing left for me to do because everything dried up very quickly and no incentive for me to find anything to do. So this is what I did. The new guy had this weird obsession with FaceTime and people being physically in the office. And so what I would do is I would come into the office right on time. I would shut my office door. I would do whatever there was for me to do, which was rarely very much. And then I would spend the rest of the day basically applying for jobs and watching YouTube videos. A lot of Key and Peele, if anybody. And that's how I spent the summer of 2016. The fall of 2016, I'm contacted by one partner in a two partner law firm who's looking for his first associate. He and I hit it off. We got to know each other, and I thought it'd be fun to work with him. So I switched to, I joined him as his partner as their first associate. That was fun for several months. But then in the beginning of 2017, I find that my partner, who I spend about 99% of my time working for, was about to be nominated to the Fifth Circuit. And so once again, I find myself wondering what's going to become of me. I pursue various angles, none of which enthuse me all that much. And now one day I get a call from a friend of mine, White House counsel's office. Ironically, the guy who managed my nonprofit before the change of management, who says, "Have you ever thought about the Court of Federal Claims?" And I say, "What, to be a judge?" And he says, "Yes." And I say, "Sure, happy to be considered." And again, brings me in for an interview a week later, and a week after that, my formal vetting process starts. And that summer, beginning summer 2017, I'm nominated, at which point things start going very slowly. My partner was nominated at about that time to the Fifth Circuit, and his nomination went very quickly. He was confirmed by early 2018, and he heads off. And my nomination at that point is technically isn't even pending anymore. And so that was frustrating at the time, but it turned into an opportunity. Because what I did was this: I could have, tried to just be like an income partner or left practice and gone into government or something like that. But I took a step into the unknown, and I decided that I was going to take on the clients and the matters that my partner and I had been working on, and I was going to handle them myself, make a go of it. And I did that. And I was actually able to add a few more clients of my very own. And so for about 2.5 years, I had my own practice, my own clients, my own matters, doing my own interesting things, mostly defending states against constitutional challenges to various laws. I rode out a couple of years that way. I ended up being grateful for that because I got certain kinds of, professional growth, personal growth out of having that opportunity. But, 2020 wound to the end, and finally the math worked out in the Senate to get me to a confirmation vote, and I was more than happy to accept it when it came. And that brings me, as far as I'm concerned, to the end of history for where my professional life goes. Here in I'm happy to think will be my terminal job on a fascinating court that I try to deserve to be a member of every day.
And then Dr. Lauer will do this response, and then we'll have Q&A. So the food will be in about 30 seconds. Get the queue up on kind of around this side of the room, along the back, and we'll come to the room.
Talking because bodily sustenance is obviously more important than anything I have to say. Thank you, Judge Schwartz. This is very interesting and educational for me. As some of you know, I am not the most familiar with constitutional, federal, these kinds of sexy topics. I tend to stick with good old common law. And so that's how I'm going to respond, is to think about some of the really interesting issues that the court raises in terms of fundamental law, the pre-existing issues before you get an American framework that puts new spin on the concerns that need to be considered in the nature of something like the Court of Claims. Starting with sovereign immunity, in one way, it's just terribly logical the way that that arises, because common law is called that because it is the law that's common to the whole realm. In a feudal system, you have lots and lots of lords, and the lords are to some extent the state. It's personal, and the state is not something that really exists in the 1100s. That's kind of a concept. It existed before that with the Roman Empire, and it existed afterwards. But in that period, it's all about personal governance, and you've got different lords with different rules and different local customs. You have a lot of Danish influence in the north of England because of Viking invading. It's called the Dane Law, and so certain fundamental units of government are called wapentakes, whereas in the rest of the country, they're called hundreds. And so common law is common to all of that because it comes from the king. Well, the king's court is the justice provided by the king. So the king is definitive of that justice. So how could the king be a defendant? It can't happen. It's just part of the theoretical structure. So that's where sovereign immunity really comes from. It makes sense in that context. Obviously, later on, we sort of say, well, come on, that's not really fair. Nor is it fair when you have a much expanded governmental enterprise that is doing a whole bunch more. I mean, one of the things is if you've got a bunch of individuals doing a bunch of ruling, they don't have the command and control structures to do what governments can manage these days. And so the entire framework of their governance is distinct. Instead of having legions of bureaucrats and officials to watch over everything and fine you when you go wrong and audit your tax returns and all of this kind of stuff, there are handfuls of people who are largely pitted against one another. Well, there are handfuls of people who are the revenue of the lords, but then everyone gets enlisted for government against each other. I'll give you an example. There's something called Frank Pledge that was a requirement for every person of social status at a given level to be bound in bor, which is where we get the word borrow. When you borrow something, it's in pledge to you, in a sense, because you've taken something that's not your own. And when you're in bor to one another, you're legally obligated to inform on each other if there's a crime committed. And there are periodic reviews where the king's justices, just a handful, are going to ride into town and check out what's been going on. And if they discover some version of an unpresented crime, then the whole community is liable to punishment because you're all bound to one another. And so it's a way of making people stand surety and become governance agents for themselves. So the government can't do very much. So you know what it's not doing? It's not contracting. It's not building buildings. It's not getting into all of these kind of private functions that are what the Court of Federal Claims largely deals with. So new things arise, and then they have to be dealt with. Now, the Court of Federal Claims, as Judge Schwartz pointed out, gets at interesting questions about what is the nature of a court at all. And some of my students have heard this short little version, but you know, a court originally, there are several meanings of court. There's the judicial tribunal, of course, but in a way, that's the last of the meanings. There's also, you could talk about the court of Henry VIII or the court of Queen Elizabeth. Well, what does that mean? That means the retinue of people around the crown. That they're the court. And there's also things like a basketball court or a squash court. It's a physical space. And you can see the original meaning of that in Cambridge, where all of the colleges have courts and their quadrilateral arrangements of buildings. It's a space. And so what you really do with a court originally is you have a group of people getting together in a space to exercise power. The suitors of the court, you bring suit, that's bringing a group. The suitors of the court are obliged to attend it. They're the vassals of the lord, and they all have something to do with the exercise of power by that lord. But the lord is the primus inter pares and can sort of override it. But that exercise of power then is undifferentiated. It's administrative, it's legislative, and it's judicial. So that kind of breaks out into present tense, future tense, and past tense. Present tense, I'd like to put some cows on the field, may I? The court's going to be able to give you an answer. That's going to be the executive that's going to tell you that kind of a thing. Future, I don't ever want to see cows on that field again. Can we establish a policy that that will never happen? That's legislation. Or someone put cows on the field, trampled my crops, and now I need redress. That's past tense, that's judicial. And so power eventually develops these different types, and we get the specialisms of separation of powers that we have found highly productive, and that also allow for judicial functioning to become something special, because it's all about the past rules. It's all about something went wrong back then, and there were rules existing then, and we're going to apply those. And so we, as the judges and the lawyers, are dealing with something we are not choosing, and that's fundamental to the nature of law. And it's why law matters, because it's neutral. We are not the ones choosing. There are ways for choices to be made, and that's not our job. And we have to keep ourselves all separate from that. And that, as my students have heard ad nauseum this year in particular, is why you are all entering a noble profession where this really matters, because you're the experts of this. I won't go too deep into that, but it's interesting to think about how, when issues arise, when, at what point is it a court, a judicial court, versus an administrative executive function? When is it just I'm filing a paper that says, government, you owe this, and then someone can stamp this and get my payment, and there might be some argument, but if there's going to be argument, is it for in front of the person who's just going to stamp it and then issue my payment? When does it actually become a judge? And we really need to engage all of the rights and procedures that are so important to law to make sure that we do that properly and ensure the rule of law. It's not necessarily as obvious as it can seem before you've really thought about it. And so the Court of Federal Claims is a great example of the broad phenomenon that's currently ongoing of the development of administrative law, because we have so many agencies doing so much now, so many rules that they are charged with enforcing, the FCC, the SEC, any alphabet soup of agencies. And if you don't like what they're telling you you must do, you challenge what they're saying. And in one sense, it's just someone has stamped something and said, now you need to go do this. And you're saying, no, I don't want to. Well, do you just go right back in front of a different person with a stamp, or is it going to be a court? And so these administrative tribunals are in a bit of a limbo between being stamping executive action and gaveling judicial exercise. Fortunately, the Court of Federal Claims has been established clearly as a court and functions as such. There's not ambiguity on it. But the story that we got of its origination helps exemplify a phenomenon that's currently ongoing with all of these other agencies and what they're doing. And I'm not sure how much awareness there is of this as a phenomenon, because it gets at the heart of what it is to have a country ruled by law and not by people. Last thing I'll say, Court of Federal Claims is very interesting because one of the things it's a fascinating hybrid of private and public law, and maybe you don't have to worry about those terms, private and public law, but they can at least be interesting conceptually. So what do I even mean by that? Well, private law is classically when you and I sue one another over something. We have a contract breach, we have a tort claim, some kind of property issue has arisen. It's just us as private citizens out there. We've got to fight. We'll go to the state to give us this forum where it's going to get settled, but the state's just standing there saying, look, this is really your problem. I have rules. I'll help you. I'll enforce those, but it's a private matter. Public law is something where we all together, the republic, is involved. So criminal law, it is the government as a party, and it affects all of us to the extent that when crimes are committed, it's damaged the fabric of society in a fashion that means we have to treat it in that way. It's not just victim, hey, sue your victimizer with a private prosecution or something, which it was for a very, very long time. So public laws, classically where the government is a party and things are affecting all of us. And so here we've got the government is a party every time in the federal court of claims, but a lot of it are things like contract actions. They're just behaving as a private party. And then that even it raises a question. I mean, we're going to move to question and answer right now. So maybe if I could, I'll start off with the first question to Judge Schwartz and ask, because when you've got a fundamentally private law claim toward contract or something being brought against the government, whose law do you apply? Because as you know from Erie, that's state law stuff that if it's private parties in a federal court, they're going to choose the law of the state to apply. And I don't know how it works in this context.
That's a very, very interesting question. There are some situations, I believe, where you apply local property law, for example, when you're dealing with takings of property. But there are other situations where there's a body of law that's, I mean, obviously a lot of it is regulatory law. So you apply whatever the relevant statute is, whatever the relevant regulations are. As far as contract law, you wouldn't really be applying state law because federal law is essentially a creature of regulation. It's created by it's created by a set of a vast body of regulations in the code of federal regulations. So the result is that unlike in other kinds of cases, there usually is a body of federal law to apply to these private law situations rather than looking to state law.
Do you think that's a good thing? Or is the centuries law, right?
It's the law that I apply and that I'm bound to apply. I can certainly see good reasons that for the federal government whose operations spread across the whole continent and beyond, that the federal government would want for its own operations be governed, its own operation be governed by something more consistent from place to place.
Do you have, so because you're an Article 1 for, I assume there's no official equity power, but do you have any discretion when you're dealing with cases, or is it purely legalistic all the way?
Are you one of the people taking equity right now? Okay, you're not one of the people in equity. So there are some equitable powers that we have. So at the core of pretty much everything we do, there's a claim for damages. There are some situations though where equitable issues come in. So for example, there are some situations where a litigant can come in and seek a declaration on the meaning of a federal contract, and there are some situations in the federal acquisition and contracting process where people can come in for injunctive relief. So in those situations, we operate basically like other courts do, and facing similar kinds of issues. So when someone comes in asking for a preliminary injunction, to halt some kind of federal procurement process, we act like other courts do. We look for their likelihood of success on the merits and balance of the equities and the public interests and irreparable harm and so forth. So in that sense, we end up with discretion to craft our relief in the way other courts do and in equitable situations.
And we're back. So, what weight should all the English common law be given in Article 3 federal courts? Because Article 3 courts get their grant of power in the U.S. Constitution and not the English Crown. And that power is pretty much to decide cases and controversies, which is meant to pretty much limit its scope. Because, I mean, this is something I'm actually doing right now for paper. And it seems like applying English common law in Article 3 federal courts creates a conflict by one, applying law from a different sovereign, but also two, that such common law can be inconsistent with the scope and limitations of federal courts, especially when as it applies to advisory opinions.
I wish I could comment on that. It's an interesting issue. It's not something that comes up in front from me. I don't have a strong view about what should happen off an Article 3 world, but it's a wonderful question to be thinking about.
Did you talk about the structure of the position, like you alluded to earlier, like just the tenure?
Sure. Oh yeah. So here's what we've got. So what I have is a 15-year term. At the end of the 15-year term, this is what happens. I can be reappointed for another 15-year term and so forth until I reach a certain age, at which point I can retire, much the way federal district judges do when they retire at a particular age. So at some point I'd be old enough and have enough years of service to retire with my benefits for life by statute. But if I'm not reappointed, this is what happens. If I send the president at that time a letter saying that I am willing to be reappointed, and then the president does not reappoint me, I take senior status at the end of my 15-year term. Senior status means I get all the money for the rest of my life, but I can't be made to work more than 25% time without my consent. I could retire then get all the money and go back into practice, in which case I get the money without a cost of living increase for the rest of my life, or I can just take a 25% caseload and do some volume of work as long as I'm willing and able to do it, and the chief judge of the court delegates it to me. I will be 52 then, so that seems like kind of a nice way to ride out my golden years. When my nomination was dragging on, I mentioned that in order to be eligible for that, you need to write the president a letter saying you're willing to be reappointed. I kind of amused myself by composing the most equivocal and lukewarm offers of willingness to be reappointed that I could concoct in my head. But we'll see whatever happens.
See, did you want to speculate and have, like, by what authority would you be working quicker as the term is expired?
Oh, so the statute says you if your term expires, you can be a senior judge. Cool. So there's a statute that gives me that authority. What's that? I do have a form of life tenure by statute.
How often does the court say advisory opinions? Was there a specific political reason in the 80s that, like, that power?
That is so interesting, because it's been years, I think, since there's been what they call a congressional reference case. So in practice, it doesn't happen anymore. Congress just hasn't executed. It could refer private bills to us for a recommendation, but it hasn't. As far as the specific reason, I think these private bills and requests for and references for recommendations on private bills used to be more common than they are now. I suppose maybe Congress wanted to keep that in reserve, but it's very rare to the point of not existent now.
I'll add to that. So private bills were a phenomenon for centuries, very, very normal. And if you look at the statutes of the realm, which is a big historical collection of statutes from Parliament, there's public acts and private acts. It's always divided into two, and they're often, and this is on Wikipedia, if you don't have access to what's reported. They tend to be similar in number. And so there were various challenges that the Commonwealth would present, and for instance, we're an aristocrat, when you're telling you to get rid of your land, best to get Parliament to pass a bill about it, because Parliament was sovereign, and so that's a guarantee. So private bills were very long for a very long time. Also, the blending of the power functions in law and non-law and judicial and so on, meant that the judges were seen as proper advisors of the king for a long time. I mean, they become judges because they are is the king delegating royal authority to do judging to them because they're the best people for it. And so for a very long time, there's this notion that, yeah, there ought to be this information. This is a good and proper function. And Professor Borsett has a paper on the history of advisory opinion that goes more into how it came to be suspicious. And there's an interesting history about that that he sort of talks about in terms of how it worked in colonial India and Canada in the 18th century. You get to the point where advisory opinions seem kind of wrong. So there's a long history of this kind of thing, which as you said, I think this is why it's there. Because it's not the anomaly historically that it sort of seems to be now.
We think there were thousands of them a year in as late as early 20th century. So 100 years ago, there were tons and tons of them, and Congress needed place to delegate them. But now it's much less common.
And also another thing, in England until 2009, when great violence was done by Tony Blair to the constitutional structure because he didn't like Gary Irvine, who was the Lord Chancellor previously. The highest court of appeal in England was the House of Lords, the body of the legislature. And that was because these kinds of private bills, parliamentary sovereignty, was how you could finally address a legal case. Well, it had been many centuries since the House had voted on an actual case. They had consistently delegated it to the law lords, who were the Supreme Court justices of England. It's not Britain, Scotland, separate legal system. And then there is now a Supreme Court of England and Wales. All they did was just take the law lords out of the House of Lords, moving across the street into what used to be Middlesex County Hall, and they made it separate. So legislature making legal determinations also is all a lot more was. Sorry, we should go you first because that's what you're talking about.
As one of the nation's few, of course, with national jurisdiction, how does that affect the operation claim approach cases?
That's fun. So we can have cases come in from all over, and there's a statute that says we're supposed to hold our proceedings wherever it's most convenient for the parties and witnesses. So that means that my chambers are in Washington, but I could have a trial any place. What we do is we basically contact the local district court and set up a chambers wherever the parties a chambers and a trial courtroom where parties would need it. So just the other day, I got a status report from the parties suggesting we hold a trial in New York this fall. So I'll be packing off there. It's a fun way to, I mean, I'm going to enjoy it because it's a fun way to see different parts of the world, and it's a service to the parties because, like you say, we're a court of national jurisdiction. We don't have a local district. We need to go where they are.
Judge, I have a question about the lifetime tenure test. We are at sort of the end of our careers. We kind of expect, I think, most of us to work in many different law firms or even nonprofits to change what we do over the course of our career and to grow as lawyers through change. As a judge, you know, I'm fairly static. You sort of in a lighter way said, oh, I plan to be here for the rest of my life. Does that make you happy? Do you have the opportunity to grow as a judge over your career? Or does that feel like limited to your?
I don't think so. I think that I can grow by pursuing excellence wherever I am, and I can pursue excellence for the next, you know, not quite 14 years of my term perfectly well. So I periodically talk with my wife about the fact that ever since I started college, so more than 20 years ago, one or the other of us has had either a physical move or a job change or a new family member every year. sometimes more than one of those things in a year. The only quiet year during all of that was 2012 when we got engaged. That's it. This year is yet another year when we've got a job change. I am looking forward to a period of some stability. I think I'll enjoy not constantly looking for the next thing or worrying about what's going to come next. And it'll be nice to think of growth as learning new material, learning how to apply old material better, figuring out what new stuff is coming. I look forward to that kind of growth in the future.
Given the unique nature and jurisdiction of the court, how should students who are interviewing judges on the court prepare themselves? For example, they haven't taken veterans' claims law, IT, things along that nature.
But everywhere you go to clerk, you'll be learning new material. There's nothing strange about that. Some background things that you'll be learning now, like civil procedure and evidence and administrative law. Those kinds of things are applicable to the Court of Federal Claims just the way they'd be applicable if you were going to work at a district court or a court of appeals. So there's nothing strange about needing to. There's nothing strange about going into the Court of Federal Claims with new material to learn. That's just par for the course, and that's par for the course any place you'd be clerking. As far as what you might need to do if you want to clerk instead of demonstrating mastery in subject matter, which I think most people probably don't expect. What I ask about is questions designed to get at people's how people approach legal questions methodologically. So, what Supreme Court cases interest them? What Supreme Court cases they agree with and disagree with, methodological issues about how they approach legal questions. Plus, I like to get a sense of people's intellectual depth. I like talking to somebody who has background and interest to give us something to talk about. I interview more interesting and qualified and bright and fun people in a year than I have the opportunity to hire, but it's nice to be able to choose among people who've got personal and intellectual depth.
You mentioned having different rules of civil procedure than the ones applied in district court. I wonder about the rules of evidence. If I wanted to pose the deputy undersecretary for soybean futures, do I have a better shot at getting that from you or my local pre-judge?
So we do apply the rules of evidence. So the question of who gets deposed, I guess that ought to be consistent from the Court of Federal Claims to another place. So it's never come up with me. As far as whether it's easier in one place or another place, I really don't know. It never came up in my private practice. It hasn't come up for me yet. Wish I knew.
Same rules.
Yeah, but the rules of evidence though apply consistently across the courts.
Usually you deal with tax refunds as well. So how are you decide whether it goes to you or the tax court or just generally your court?
So as between us and the tax court, if it's prepayment, it goes to the tax court. If it's post-payment, it can come to us. I've got one big-ish tax case that I'm going to need to sort out. I've only had one one tax case come very far with me so far. It ended up going out on a really interesting statute of limitations issue where I got to disagree with the tax court on something. They were interpreting some regulations wrong.
One more question if we have one,
if not.
Anything else?
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.